Throwing cheese on the Big Swing Podcast with Blue Jays pitcher Ross Stripling and co-host Cooper Searles.
What's going on, swingers? Welcome to another episode of the Big Swing Podcast. I am your co-host Cooper Searles, joined as always by my podcast compadre, Blue Jays pitcher Ross Stripling. What's going on, bub?
Coop, what's up, dude? As we press launch on this podcast, there's 3:30 left in the national championship. Baylor's spanking that booty, so we wanted to go ahead and start. Might as well start the podcast because it looks like this one's it's going to end the way it is.
Yeah, this is the psychology behind the podcast. Usually it's like, all right, let's wait till whatever event is over and then we'll record after. This one, I think about the 7-minute mark, I was like, all right, dude, let's go ahead and hit it here. But
yeah, and we'll finish with this game and March Madness and stuff, but let's get into something else. We got some exciting stuff coming y'all's way.
Yeah, we have some new content that Ross and I are both involved. I'm more on the back end. Ross is the host of this podcast, and it's called GOAT. It is the greatest of all time on the bump. So we're talking about the greatest pitchers. So Ross, you've been recording this over the last couple months. Just kind of give a breakdown of how you see the podcast in your eyes.
Yeah, so I mean, you guys know me. You've listened to The Big Swing now for 2 years. Some of you guys, you know, I'm a nerd. I'm a history guy. I'm a numbers guy. This podcast is right up my alley. And it started all the way back. Gosh, it started all the way back in that crazy 2020 season last year when I was still a Dodger. I recorded with Walker Buehler and Clayton Kershaw. And basically, it's me and a current big leaguer sitting down, current big league pitcher sitting down and talking about an all-time great pitcher of the past. You know, with Clayton, we talked about Sandy Koufax. So we also tried to find guys that they kind of comp to, right? Guys that pitched similar to them that you could say, you know, yeah, Sandy Koufax was the Clayton Kershaw of the 1940s, 50s. You know, we did Pedro Martinez with Walker Buehler. We did Tim Lincecum with Trevor Bauer. And gosh, man, we did a bunch, just to go through them. And I'll go through them a little bit later. But basically, just think of like a history of pitching podcast of the greatest pitchers now talking about the greatest pitchers that have ever done it. So if that sounds like it's up your alley, check it out, because the first episode's coming out April 13th, and it's the Clayton Kershaw, Sandy Koufax episode, and it's awesome. I just listened to it. Cooper was on the back end as part of editing it, and he knows how great it is. So if you love pitching, I mean, this couldn't be more up your alley. So stay tuned for April 13th.
Yeah, honestly, we looked around, and we were like, we didn't see anything like this. And I guess the simplest way to describe it is the greatest pitchers of today talking about the greatest pitchers ever. And you just don't get to hear those conversations often. And you know, Ross having relationships with some of the best players in the game, like where else are you going to get Clayton Kershaw talking about Sandy Koufax? Like if you're a Dodgers fan or just a baseball fan in general, that is like premium content for you. So yeah, GOAT, it's going to be coming out. What is it? April 13th, Ross? Is that correct?
April 13th. Yeah, first episode.
April 13th, first episode. We're going to be opening up with the Clayton Kershaw and Sandy Koufax episode. So, yeah, it's going to be weekly, and we're going to have a bunch of awesome episodes talking about some of the greatest pitchers ever. So I think you guys are going to love it. Hopefully one day we'll, you know, go into the greatest batters, the greatest basketball players, the greatest everything, and have a series. But for now, we're sticking with what we know, and that's the greatest pitchers.
Yeah, so this is going to be from the same guys that do our podcast, which is Jam Street Media, you know, and obviously Cooper as well. So, and just to line it up, kind of give you an idea so guests, as in the guys that are on the podcast that I'm talking to, Clayton Kershaw, Trevor Bauer, Alex Wood, Jameson Taillon, Walker Buehler, Michael Wacha, Tyler Duffy, Robbie Ray, and guys we're going to be talking about, Sandy Koufax, Tim Lincecum, Warren Spahn, John Smoltz, Pedro Martinez, Bob Gibson, Greg Maddux. There's also more. So just those 8 to 10 names I just listed, some of the guys that have ever, best players, best pitchers that have ever graced major league mounds. And we're going to be doing deep dives on all of them. So it's pretty cool, guys. Just check it out. Be ready for it. They're only about half hour long. They're not crazy, but we definitely get the information across that you want to know about each guy. They're a ton of fun to record, and you guys are going to love them.
Perfect, man. Well, we're going to be out on the lookout for them. We can't wait for them to drop, and hope you guys enjoy the hell out of them, because they've been a project we've been working on for quite a while now, and we're really proud of them. So check out GOAT on the bump coming April 13th. So let's get into some baseball talk right now, man. Season started. You opened and pitched in Yankee Stadium for the first time. Man, I got to hear about that experience, because I love talking to you about the Fenway experience. Like, as a fan of sports in general, I think the baseball stadiums and baseball fields are just the coolest to me. Like, if I could go to all the stadiums, it'd be baseball stadiums. And Yankee Stadium's got to be on that list. So how was that, man?
Yeah, Yankee Stadium's awesome. And to pitch their opening weekend with fans in the stands, there was only 10,000 of them. They all had to get COVID tested ahead of time, but it felt like there were 40,000 people there. And, man, you like kind of come over a bridge and all of a sudden you're in the Bronx and Yankee Stadium just kind of like sitting there on the horizon. And it's really cool looking, all the flags at the top. And then, you know, it's still fairly new, but it has that old school baseball feel to it. Really, really cool spot to pitch. As a team, man, we did great. We went there and took two or three from the Yankees. You know, a lot of people, including our man Tim Kirchin from last week, have them in the World Series. So, you know, the Bluebirds are here to stay, man. We have a lineup that's relentless. We run really good arms out of the bullpen, and we got starters that can really pitch too. And guys like Robbie Ray and Thomas Hatch and others coming that are on the DL right now. So, you know, to go in there and take two or three from them is big. And then personally, you know, I want to kind of touch on my outing for a second, but first off, just say, you know, I took the one loss that we got, so that's a bummer, but felt like I pitched really well and had good stuff. Just kind of had, they found some holes and worked some good counts, worked some long at-bats, and that's the way pitching is, man.
It is. It's so interesting. You can really have your best stuff, but if they kind of have you figured out that day, it doesn't matter. It's almost like, you know, great offense beats bad defense in basketball or something like, or great offense beats great defense in basketball. It's sort of similar to that, but just I don't know. I kind of think about historically, like when, you know, in whenever your career is over and you can kind of look back, how would you rank the stadiums? Like if you could go three stadiums that you've played in, like what are the three stadiums that stick out to you the most?
Yeah, good question. You know, I always say Wrigley and Fenway are like 1A and 1B, and you get the history and the feel for like what baseball was like even 100 years ago, because those stadiums have been around so long. They've also done some renovations to those stadiums where it's much better for the visiting team than it was a couple years ago. And just the fan, I've been able to play both places in the postseason where they're electric and it's just a blast. So those are really like one and two by a landslide. And then three, honestly, most people and myself included, I think, would put Dodger Stadium. You know, it's just you go up on that fourth deck, you look over the outfield, the Hollywood signs there in the background, the weather's always perfect. But obviously, I'm a little biased there. I haven't played there for 5 years. I think really my third is San Francisco.
Yep.
I love it. You know, kind of the weather coming off the water is always crazy. You never know what you're going to get. It might be 50 degrees in the middle of the summer. And it's just a great place to pitch because the park is huge. I like the city of San Francisco. I obviously had the rivalry between the Dodgers and the Giants that always made that entertaining. So I usually say Fenway 1, Wrigley 2, San Francisco 3.
I love the San Francisco park. I've never been to it, but anytime I see that stadium on TV or think about it, I think about Barry Bonds in those years just launching them into the water and watching the boats and the canoes run around out there. It brings back such a great memory. I absolutely love that stadium. So I'm glad that's on your list. But the stadium that got me pumped, and you're there now, you're in your hometown of Dallas, but it was, I don't know, it made me feel so good to see everyone in that stadium, like all the fans there. It really was the first time, you know, in this whatever year and a half stretch we've been going through this COVID stuff where I turned on my TV and it felt normal and like the world seemed to be back on track. And, you know, you can have your opinions on it or what, but it I think everyone can agree that it just felt good to see.
Yeah. I mean, I was in the dugout for it. 40,000 people. You forget what it feels like, man. Like the energy that's buzzing through the air, just the white noise that you hear from people between pitches and all that kind of stuff. And then the microphone wasn't working that well for the national anthem. You could like kind of barely hear the guy that was playing. So you could hear the 40,000 people singing the national anthem, which was like kind of giving me chills. And then, you know, we beat the Rangers. So the crowd didn't necessarily have a ton to get fired up about. But when they did, it felt like a roar. And it just, you know, kind of reminds you why you do it. Obviously, you're there to play baseball and to help a team win baseball games. But you kind of do it for the fans and for the 40,000 people that are there screaming, having a good time. We're in the entertainment industry, right? So it was really cool, man. 40,000 people. I think that was just for opening day. Pretty sure they limit it now to 50% or something like that moving forward, but it's still going to feel like there's a million people there.
Yeah, and you mentioned it, man. The money is great. The winning is great. But all of you guys that are playing in the league were fans and were going to ballparks as kids. And like the reason why you fell in love with the game is the atmosphere and being around people and wanting to perform in front of a crowd. And yeah, to see that back, it made me so happy. I was scrolling down Instagram And I noticed like a video of the crowd, and I scrolled past it really quick thinking it was just like an old highlight, an old baseball highlight. And I kind of thought about it for a second. I was like, man, that's the Ranger Stadium, isn't it? And so I scrolled back up, and I just had a big smile on my face, man. It was so awesome to see.
Well, it's really cool because it's a brand new stadium, right? And they didn't get it. Really, it's 2 years old because last year was the opening of the stadium, but they didn't get to have fans besides for the bubble and the World Series, which obviously the Rangers weren't in. So, you know, the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex showed up, ready to have a good time, ready to support the team, ready to support the new stadium, and they did. And, you know, obviously they probably wish they got a win on opening day, or I guess, yeah, obviously they wish they got a win on opening day, but not the way the chips fell for them, but still, they packed the house in a pandemic and, you know, are a sign that the world's headed in the right place, maybe a little faster in Texas than most would want, but we're getting there.
Yeah, you mentioned new stadium, which indeed it is a new stadium, but it is essentially a remake of Minute Maid Park. As a Houstonian going to Minute Maid for a long time, it looks like a shot-for-shot remake. Damn near.
You think? I didn't.
Did it feel like that in the stadium? It was
no.
When the first pictures dropped of the stadium and the rendering and everything, that was like a lot of the heat they were getting. Like everyone from Houston was like, looks like Minute Maid.
The outfield. Yeah, the outfield.
The green, the green beams and stuff in the top of the stadium and all that. And the outfield looks similar. But
yeah, so I wanted to run back and at bat from that Yankees game and just kind of give you guys some insight into, I don't know, what's going on in my head and, you know, for a pitcher and a pitcher playing the chess match with a batter and how it can kind of basically alter an entire outing. You know, feel pretty good about where I was at in my outing. I was through three innings, had given up one run, had given up some hits, had some traffic on the bases, had survived it. And we're going now into the fourth inning. And between innings, I'm talking with my catcher, Danny Jansen, who is a great catcher. Love throwing to him. And we got Gary Sanchez coming up. And Gary is a free swinger. He swings at the first pitch all the time. I got him out in the first at bat with like a slider down and away, broke his bat, ground out to shortstop. And a lot of times you'd say like, okay, this guy's probably taking this next one, right? He's not going to go for a first pitch out again, so let's just get ahead with a strike. And Danny's like, no, dude, I faced these guys a bunch of times. Let's do it again. Slider down and away again. I think he's going to swing. Might get the same result. All right, cool. Let's do that. From there, we're going to go fastball up, and then we're going to bounce a curveball. Hopefully punch him out. We should have him out. All right, sweet. You know, that's kind of what you're doing between innings. You're planning for the hitter, and the hitter's coming up. So we go out there. I go slider down and away. He doesn't swing, but it was a good one down and away for first strike. And I go fastball up and away, swing through. So I got him 0-2 right where I want him. And I throw him this crappy curveball. He pulls it foul at like 110 miles an hour. So then I try and go up. And all I got to do is throw it like belly button high to a little bit higher. And you got a real chance to, you know, swing and miss or change his eye level at least. Maybe he pops it up, whatever. That's a hard pitch to do damage on. Instead, I throw it like head high. And then I think I bounce another curveball and I throw another one head high. He fouls off another curveball, and then I throw another one head high. So now, when I had him 0-2, exactly where I want him, had him set up like we talked about between innings, exactly where I want him, I don't execute two pitches. So now I have him back in the count, 2-2. That's an action pitch. When you're throwing something 2-2, you want to get a result there, strikeout, ball in play, whatever. And because I now basically feel like I have to throw a strike, I throw a much more competitive slider in the zone, which is not a good pitch to Gary Sanchez. He hammers in zone spin, hammers it, and I throw him just like an okay one. Actually, really not that great. He has way too much plate, and he muscles it out for a homer. So now I'm sitting at what I think is, you know, a decent outing going, three innings, one run, got the guy 0-2, to now three innings, two runs, had just given up a homer. The momentum's changed, and my whole outing kind of, not like goes to crap from there, but struggles from there. I get the next guy out, then I walk a guy, get DJ LeMahieu to 2-0, feel like I throw him a really good slider down and away, hits it right on the ground, which is what we're hoping for, thinking it's a double play off the bat to being through the shift. So now I got first and second, one out in the fourth inning, and I'm pulled. And that's my outing. When really, if I just execute against Gary Sanchez and expand a little bit, not a ton like I did, but just execute, get him out, struck out the next guy, and now I'm, you know, sitting at 3 2/3 with two outs, looking to finish my fourth inning, maybe get into the fifth, hopefully the sixth, and, you know, ease up on my bullpen and all that. And I know this is really long-winded, but this is kind of the, you know, that's big league pitching, and that's a big league outing, and how fast it can go from pretty good to over. So now over. I give up three runs in 3 1/3, and took the loss in Yankee Stadium opening weekend. You know, so it can change on you just like that because I didn't execute two pitches that I really should have against a guy that had already gotten out, that I had him on his heels, I had him off balance, I had him right where I wanted, and I throw two crappy pitches, and then I got to throw him a strike, and he muscles it for a homer, and my whole outing's over 10 pitches later.
Yeah, that's a great breakdown. Like, you don't get to hear the inside the mind of what's going through when things are not spiraling, but starting to go for you a little bit. And what I'm hearing when I'm listening to you is, what I'm thinking about is like how hard it is to place a baseball where you want it to. Like at its purest form, how hard it is to just put that ball exactly where you need it. Because when I'm listening to you talking, you had the plan all together. You and your catcher had talked it out. You knew exactly where to go with that ball. And probably if you would have executed that pitch exactly where you wanted to, like you said, things would have turned for you. But, you know, just having it that inch or two off, you know, affected the entire game. And that's just crazy to think, like, how difficult it is to place a baseball within a square inch every time. And, you know, I can't even fathom. Like, I can't even hit a pole with a rock from 10 feet. You know what I mean? So I could see how frustrating and difficult that is as a pitcher. We're like, man, I have done everything right. Mentally, I'm ready to, I'm locked in, but I just missed it by 2 inches.
And that's my game, right? Like, I'm not a guy that throws 97. I got to throw the ball where I want to, where it needs to go, what the scouting report says it needs to go. And, you know, when I can't do that, it's frustrating. And that's when things can fall apart on me because I'm not, you know, 2-1, 3-1, 2-0 counts are nightmares for me because I can't just rear back and throw you a 97 mile an hour challenge heater like a lot of guys can in today's game. And, you know, I really got to pitch out there. So when I have count leverage, I got to take advantage of it for reasons that I just said. It can all of a sudden turn on me and I've given up a homer. I got another guy on base and now I'm really battling when I could have set myself up for a clean inning.
No, super cool. So yeah, real time. This is a real time reaction. The game just ended. Baylor is the 2021 national champion, the first national champion we've had in 2 years. That is their first national championship as a school. And man, we're not the biggest Baylor guys, but I have absolutely fell in love with this team. Like, they play their ass off. They're fun. They're athletic. They got a bunch of fast guards. And they came out in this game and put their foot on Gonzaga's throat in the first 2 minutes of this game.
Yeah. You know, as a guy that watched a lot of college basketball this year, I felt like I watched some Baylor, and I must not have, because I would have rode this team hard in brackets and everything, because if they look like this all year, I mean, they were like head and shoulders more athletic than basically every team they played. I must have been just watching like Iowa and those Big Ten schools that ended up struggling in the tournament. You know, initial thought is Gonzaga's a good team. I know you're on them. A lot of people were on them. They were undefeated for a reason. I think if you put them in the Big 12 or the Big 10, they probably have 8 losses after watching that. I mean, Baylor was running circles around them. They're so much more explosive. They're faster, quicker, out-rebounded them, killed them on the offensive glass, forced uncharacteristic turnovers from Gonzaga. I know Timmy is awesome. He had a great March Madness, all that good stuff, but he had no business running with those kids from Baylor today and banging with them down low. He was exposed, in my opinion. It was just Baylor was just a better team, start to finish.
Yeah, the Timmy stuff, you know, I think in the last couple games, people, like, I've seen people on Twitter, like, I just don't understand why he's not being talked about as a lottery pick. Why isn't he a top 10 pick? And when I see those tweets, I immediately know that those aren't real basketball fans.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're talking about. And you see it tonight when you have, like, an athletic team and big guys that are aggressive going for rebounds, you see like his deficiencies. And I mean, he's a great player. And this Gonzaga team is an incredible team. They're complete. They have multiple draft picks on this team. They would have been good in any conference, but I do agree. This is a team that hadn't had to play a level of athleticism of a Big 12 or SEC or ACC. And you saw in the two games that they really played these big time schools, like in UCLA that are getting 5-star kids, and Baylor, they're now like an elite program. They struggled to like keep up athletically. And, you know, I wanted Gonzaga to have a perfect season. They could have gone 31-0, I think it was, but, you know, I'm feeling good. I had Gonzaga in the points, so I won a little bit of money tonight. I'm sorry, I had Baylor in the points, so I won a little bit of money tonight. But Gonzaga perfect season would have been a really cool story to cap off this March Madness.
Yeah, like kind of sneaky, hasn't happened since the 70s or 80s, maybe, yeah. You know, so kind of cool to keep it going.
Yeah.
You know, I think it'd be awesome if Gonzaga did it, but the team that I want to go undefeated is like the team that goes through the gauntlet. Like I want a Kentucky to do it or a Duke to do it or a North Carolina to do it. Like that would feel pretty cool. Gonzaga, I know they played a tough non-conference schedule to start the season. Obviously, got to go through March Madness and beat the best, but they play like 15 games in the middle there where they just waxed everyone by 25.
Yeah, it is unfortunate this game wasn't closer because they said at the beginning of the game, this is the best combined record for a national championship with two teams. And like you would have thought on paper, this was would line up to be like an all-time game. And it was a big letdown. Thankfully, we had this game in the Final Four from Gonzaga that really like pushed this tournament into the national spotlight. But, you know, I'm a huge college basketball fan. You've gotten into it this season. And I think that they needed a really great national championship. So I am kind of upset that it didn't go as planned.
Well, and I like that they got the two best teams. I'm with you that, I wish it was a closer game. Technically, Gonzaga played them even from like the 8-minute mark on. They just got off to such a bad start that they were playing catch up the rest of the game. But, you know, you think of how crazy the brackets were, everyone's brackets got busted. Well, really, the two best teams rose to the top and you know, came to the occasion and faced off. And maybe most people thought Gonzaga was the best, but turns out Baylor was head and shoulders better, at least this game in this tournament. And, you know, we got a national champion, which is cool. We've gotten a World Series champion. We got a Super Bowl champion. We got a college basketball champion. Obviously, we'll get another NBA champion. So, like, sports back on track, back on a roll. We're getting, you know, through seasons and all that stuff. And man, it's good.
It's like all I looking said, up. With, yeah.
Yeah, it's all looking up. Well said. It's all looking up.
Yeah, I think so. And it is interesting in this game that, you know, they were supposed to play like, what is it, a month and a half ago or so, or 2 months ago in the regular season, and it got canceled for COVID. And I'm curious now that we see this result, like if we would have thought differently, if we would have got to see them square off and like see how the athleticism would affect Gonzaga. We may have came into this game thinking differently. People nationally may have came into this game, you know, favoring Baylor. Now that we're looking at it, this game should have been a pick 'em. This, I don't think Gonzaga shouldn't even have been favored. I thought coming into this game, 4.5 points was a little bit much.
I would agree. I think Baylor showed enough through the tournament that they shouldn't have given up that many points.
On deck in the Big Swing Podcast, the Beast of the Week with Strip and Coop.
All right, guys, welcome back. Baylor Bears, national champions. With that, we're going to move into our Beast of the Week segment. Every week, Coop and I like to pick out something from sports, pop culture, something that sticks out to us. We call it our Beast of the Week. So with that, Coop, who's your Beast of the Week?
Yeah, for me, this is a pretty simple one. This is Shohei Ohtani. I don't know if he's going to be a Hall of Famer. I don't know if he's going to be a superstar. I really don't know what his future is. But what I do know is it's just awesome. Like, it's just cool. This guy, in the same game, pitched a 101-mile-per-hour fastball and then just blast a home run into the moon in the same game. And, like, this is something that, you know, like, rivals, like the Deion Sanders type of stuff. Like, you know, guys that can do multiple things you just don't get to see very often. And, I'm so hopeful that he is as good as we think he's going to be and that he stays healthy because there's just nothing like it in baseball. And I think he makes the game more exciting. And he's just great for the game. So, yeah, Shohei Ohtani, absolute beast of the week, 101-mile-per-hour fastball, and then blast a homer in the same inning.
Yeah, just, like, not something you see in baseball anymore, the two-way player. You know, I think back in the day it was common, but now it's basically doesn't exist. And to be elite at both, you know, to throw 100 and to be able to hit a ball 450 feet, and they're who we play right when we get back. So we got a couple more games here in Texas, and then we go back and we play the Angels in Dunedin, Florida. So I'm about to face them. You know, that's a gauntlet, man. You go through Trout, Rendon, and Ohtani right there. That's about as good of a trio as anyone's got in the big league. So, yeah, we'll get to see it firsthand here coming up.
So I heard this on Pardon My Take, which is a great podcast, but they were having this conversation. Can he pitch and then go back into the field or DH and hit, and then can he go back and pitch since he never, does that make sense?
So like
can he go back and pitch
like
the second time in the game? Like he can start the game and then go in and be a DH and then close the game?
Good question. I mean, my I guess the obvious answer is no. There's no way.
Yeah, the obvious answer is no.
Yeah, but I don't know like what the rule book says.
Yeah, because you like technically didn't come out of the game.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yes. I mean, maybe there's just no team stupid enough that they do that to their own player, especially right. someone like yeah. a superstar in Shohei Ohtani. So maybe it is allowed and just no one is actually willing to do it.
All right, Ross, who's your beast of the week?
Yeah, so this is probably the first time we've ever done two baseball players beast of the nice. Week. So I did a guy named, I'm probably butchering it. It's either Yermin or Yermin Mercedes. He's a right-handed hitter for the Chicago White Sox. Started his career 8-for-8. Most consecutive hits ever to start your career in the modern era. Five of them came with two strikes. You know, that White Sox lineup is not lacking big righties, and now they got another one. So quick and easy, Yermin Mercedes, 8-for-8 to start your big league career. That's awesome, man. Never been done before, so obvious beast of the week.
Two baseball players. For the first time, I do think you're right. I don't think we've had it yet.
Yeah, it doesn't
unless we've shared the same one.
Doesn't sound like something we'd do.
So I wanted to bring it up again about our new podcast coming out on Dream Street Media. It's going to be coming out April 13th. I just wanted to remind you guys that's next Tuesday. It is an amazing podcast. It's called GOAT on the Bump. It is about the greatest pitchers told to you by Ross and some of the greatest pitchers in the game. So please go check that out. We will let you know more on the Instagram and stuff. How you can subscribe and how you can, you know, find it and everything. But stay tuned for it. It's going to be an awesome one. All right, swingers. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. As always, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @BigSwingPodcast. You can find me @CooperSearles. Ross, where can they find you?
I am @RossStripling on Twitter, @Ross_Stripling on Instagram.
All right, swingers. We'll see you next time.